being able to sit in the stands and watch a competition and be really removed from even that training process made us realize just what a gift that is to be able to wake up every day and pursue something that you believe in, and to feel like there's a whole team of people around you committed and invested in your success. And, you know, being a finite period of time in your life, we realized, okay, we want to do things differently, and we wanted to work with different coaches. We wanted to have a different style. We wanted to explore a different way of training. Ice dance is really archaic in its methods, and we wanted to sort of advance that and simply disrupt some things in the figure skating world. So I think that really kind of got us excited again.
That's five-time Olympic medalist Tessa Virtue, and this is Difference Makers, a Christina Walker podcast. Welcome back, or welcome to Difference Makers. I'm your host, Christina Walker, current national team rower in pursuit of great conversation. This week, we have the one and only Tessa Virtue. Tessa and her skating partner, Scott Moyer, are the most decorated Canadian ice dance team of all time, as well as the most decorated Olympic figure skaters of all time. Through this conversation, we discuss the importance of speaking truths, being vulnerable, and her journey as a top performer. Tessa is such a humbled, kind, and insightful person, and this conversation was one that I will always remember. Before we get going, once again, this podcast is sponsored by Marathon Surfaces, suppliers of rubberized surfacing for running tracks, walking paths, and safety surfacing for playgrounds. Now please welcome the incredible Tessa Virtue.
My connections to rowing are, well, Marnie McBean was like the difference maker in my career, I think. So her mentoring and mentorship of us. Kim McQueen was my naturopath. I don't know. Do you guys work with her?
Oh, yeah. She's my dietitian right now. So
love her. And Kristen Barnes I worked with for mental. Like,
oh, wow. Nice.
I don't know if she's still involved with the rowing team or not, but in some way connected to your sport. And I will also say that Scott read Boys in the Boat before one Olympics. And like that was our big thing, was to find swing. Is that right? Together?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he always referenced that. And it was just like this pursuit of ours that I just felt like, you know, probably couldn't find two different sports, ice dance and rowing, mechanically speaking. But I thought it was so interesting just from a team standpoint, how we drew from, you know, your realm.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's really awesome. I know. And I think that that's so special, and being able to draw from other sports, even when people say, or when it stands out as being so totally different, there are similarities. So I guess I wanted to dive right in first and ask you how you got into figure skating.
I started figure skating when I was six. My grade one class was going on a field trip, and I begged my grandma at the time to take me to the rink to get lessons. And I guess that's an indication of just maybe how competitive I was early on, because I didn't want to show up and not know how to do it at this, you know, little field trip. But it was just one of many activities. I grew up in I'd be curious about your family. You're one of three, right?
One of four kids.
One of four. Okay, me too. Yeah. I'm the baby. Where do you land?
Me too. Okay,
great. So, yeah, life is pretty good for the baby, but my parents really wanted to expose all of us to so many different activities and sports. That was a real emphasis on that in my house. So skating was just sort of one of those things on the list. It was not really meant to be taken seriously, but when I was seven, I was, you know, partnered up with Scott. So it was an early age to be sort of, you know, thrust into that partnership.
Wow, that's crazy. And so did you feel like that partnership kind of like originally or was pretty organic? Was there at any point where you decided like, oh no, I'm going to go and test somebody else? Or like, that's such a young age. Right?
Yeah,
like,
I think it ended up being the thing that kept us in the sport. I think this ability to work together, we both loved, I mean, eventually, not when we were seven and nine, we didn't know what we were doing. It was just like, people thought it was funny that we would hold hands and skate around the rink and not see over the board. It was just comical. So by no means did we show potential, but I think ultimately we realized later that we both loved to dance and express ourselves. We were both competitive, so we wanted to win. And, you know, if not for Scott, skating wouldn't have maintained that kind of interest. And I think you probably felt the same. I mean, there was just something eventually about being accountable to one another and being able to sort of live those dreams dependent on one another and the partnership.
Mm-hmm. When you say competitiveness, I mean, I'm always looking to find like where I got my competitiveness. And I think it can be easy to kind of turn back and be like, okay, I had three other siblings. Did you feel like you were always competing with your siblings, or did you think that you had more like an innate competitiveness?
I think it's innate for me. We're 4 years apart, all of my siblings. So there's quite an age gap. My oldest brother was off at university by the time I was in, you know, grade one, I think. So that helped, I think, the dynamic between us. And in fact, I vividly remember being at skating with my sister, and she's like a formidable athlete. I mean, I always joke that I'm the least athletic one in the family. My sister was just incredible, but she was such a gifted gymnast, and she was on the national team at a young age and like was flown to train with the Hungarian national team when she was 8 or 9. But in skating, I remember trying not to skate faster than her because I didn't want her to feel bad, or I didn't want to land a jump before maybe she had landed that. So I don't feel like that competitive nature was between us. I felt a real sense of support, but against myself, really. I mean, I just always wanted to be the best I could be in whatever that was, whether that was math class or on the ice or in the ballet studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I feel like I have similar feelings of competitiveness, but then also at the same time for myself, I do remember like my siblings are a little bit closer, and especially the second youngest, my sister, she, it's actually interesting that you say that she had like, your sister had very like an innate, talent. And I felt the same way about my sister. And there were parts and of us doing like, we used to run track together, and she would just go out and like wouldn't even train that much, but like go out and run hurdles or like 100-meter hurdles and or 400-meter hurdles and come out and come second and be really disappointed. And I would train all season, come out and come like 5th or 6th, and I'd be like, okay, nice, Christina, good job. Right. But you know, and she'd be really upset, and I was like, what, like how is this? How are you able to do this? And I think for me, I would always see her doing those things, and I would be like, you could be so much even better if you could just train a little bit more. And I think that's where I got some of my like work ethic or like drive to get better. I mean, she might not like me hearing this later in this podcast, but
we'll keep our siblings from this one. But I totally agree. I think, but there was this acceptance of, you know, this is good enough, and I can also have a social life, and I can do these different activities, and I can have hobbies and off time, and I don't have that gear. I don't understand that kind of balance. I admire it, actually. Yeah. But I'm curious, are you competitive in every facet of your life, or how does that manifest? Is it always just in sport, or?
Good question. I think for sure sport. I think there's something about, like, I would put myself as like a racer. I definitely go into like a different gear when I'm racing or when I'm side by side with somebody. I think in life I can get competitive, but I'm always competitive for like certain beliefs. So like fairness, that's a big quality of mine or belief in mine. And I think that comes from my parents of like wanting things to be fair. And so if I'm doing something and I can see, or in a, I don't know, organization or something that maybe it's not fair, then I could get really competitive to making it better. But in terms of, other things that I'm involved in, I wouldn't say so, but maybe my teammates or my friends might differ, but yeah, no, I don't think so. And I think I'm also able to kind of take a step back and not always feel like I have to prove myself 24/7 in whatever I'm doing. Like, it's okay to just, you know, let life be. Yeah. How about yourself?
I think it's generally across the board, but what was so beautiful about what you just said is that it was more value-based. Like, it's that competitive nature can unfold for the betterment of others, or that it's you know, this sort of fair playing field. I think that's really special. That will serve you so well.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. And I think the more that I can do that, then whatever the outcome is in whatever situation I'm in, I'm going to be satisfied with what happens.
Yes, when there's deeper meaning or substance behind it. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, so back to figure skating. At what point in your adolescent life did you and Scott kind of, did you ever sit down and you're like, okay, we're going to do this, keep going? Or was it just sort of like continually moving forward?
We sort of had a natural progression of, okay, we wanted to be the best in pre-novice and novice and junior and sort of working our way up. For me anyways, I don't remember the moment of wanting to be at the Olympics. I think I used to go around saying I wanted to be an Olympian, but just because I had heard my sister say that. Mm-hmm. But we did make a decision when I was 13 and he was 15 to move away from home. And we moved from London, Ontario to Waterloo. And I skipped grade 8 in order to go to high school just to better manage our schedule. Mm-hmm. We lived, you know, with billet families, and I just had a little taxi card that billed my parents, and I took taxis everywhere or the bus.
Wow.
And I remember trying to like stock up on some groceries at 7-Eleven or whatever, you know, whatever was around. Mm-hmm. And I would walk down the street to the payphone and call home because, you know, I didn't even have a cell phone at that point. So I reflect on that time just and wonder what 13-year-old Tessa was like. I think probably way more independent, but there must have been some driving force. You know, maybe even if it was in the back of my mind that, you know, we were going to really make a go of this, but it was mostly just so that we could be practicing with our, like with people that were better than us. Mm-hmm. And we knew that, you know, at that time, I believe it was novice teams. They were skating 3 hours a day in the morning. Wow. And we couldn't do that with our current setup in London. So in order to sort of keep up, we needed to make that change. It didn't seem like a big deal at the time. It was just like, this is what you had to do. But
wow,
kind of funny. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so crazy. Especially at age 13. That's, mm-hmm. that's nuts. Did you always feel around that age too? Like, I feel like did you always feel that you still loved the sport, or was it starting to kind of like go into that over competitiveness or like, oh, this is what's next? I feel like, especially at a young age of being a part of such a, intense, I don't know what the environment is, but like that's an intense experience, right, for a 13-year-old, and having that structure, but still being able to go there and be like, oh, I love what I'm doing and this is so exciting. Like, did you still have that same sort of feeling?
No, I don't think I loved it. I loved the choreography process. In the end, I loved going to competitions, being able to travel, get the tracksuit, that was so exciting for me. I loved performing in front of people. And so I think having that lasting, you know, that was sort of the end of the season was the big competition of nationals. And then we'd sit down with our parents and they'd say, do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. And we'd say yes, much to their surprise, because, you know, we would have spent most of the season sort of grinding away and probably not enjoying the process. I think I felt really anxious and frightened and sick most of my teenage years, just because it was grueling and it was so abnormal. I mean, you would know this, but it just, you know, we'd be up at 5 every day, skate for 3 hours, go to school, go right back to the rink to work out and do ballet, and then go home and do homework, but be in bed by 8 or 8:30 just so that we could wake up and do it again. So I never questioned it, but I don't think I was doing it for this like unabashed passion or love for the sport. I think I was doing it because I wanted to achieve something,
right?
And, you know, sort of picked my lane and decided to go all in. But certainly there were pockets of it that I really enjoyed, and I, you know, as then we progressed even further into our teenage years, realized it sort of does become a job. I think any kind of hobby that when it's all encompassing and it's so much a part of your life, and you mentioned that environment, like, it can be quite toxic, especially for females.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a good point. Did you find that's something that I wanted to ask you, but I guess if we wanted to go right into 2010 and that success, how did you balance that success afterwards and wanting to keep going? And I think a big reflection on that would be ego. Like, how were you able to like set aside ego of getting that fame and coming back and like, I still have to do this job and do it all over again, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't feel any sort of fame, really. We were training in Michigan at that time, so we were so far removed from that Canadian market landscape. And our day-to-day didn't change. We just were training with the same people, same coaches, same people around me. I needed a surgery actually in the fall of 2010. So I think my focus just shifted into sort of, you know, management of this injury. And what I did feel was the biggest difference maker was just that taste of Olympic success, or what, you know, all of the excitement that goes and surrounds an Olympic Games. I realized so deeply just what that meant to me and what those rings symbolized and just how freaking cool it was to represent Canada. I mean, that 3 weeks every 4 years could motivate me for, you know, another 500 years.
Wow. And what was that experience like going into 2010?
We knew nothing. Like, we were such babies. And I think our naivete was the best thing going. You know, we were so green. We didn't have one sponsor. We really weren't on anyone's radar. 3 weeks before the Olympics, I think CTV came to us and said, hey, we should probably do some feature on you guys. And so we went in prepared, but I was quite injured. And really just, we were so present. It's the first time we ever felt flow. In both our original dance and free dance, we were just so present, so in the zone. We were able to just come together in a way that we really needed to. So it was fun being an athlete, you know. It was a special experience in that capacity.
Yeah, when you say flow, how do you find flow within two people? You know, maybe you're feeling flow in that event. How is he also feeling flow? Or what was that? Did you guys ever talk about that afterwards of like, oh, we both felt that, and during?
Yes, I think within our dynamic, it would have been impossible for one of us to feel it if the other wasn't. We just needed to be so in tune and so in sync. And it wasn't even a goal of ours to sort of find that. You know, I had studied positive psychology, so I knew it existed, but I was so injured, and you just think with pressure and you just never know if that's going to be the time you are able to rise to the occasion. So it wasn't even like on our to-do list. I don't think, but we hugged before taking the ice competitively, and we synced our breathing. Is that the right way to say that? And it matched our breathing up, and we just were so in tune. And I think because of the injury, you probably know and have unfortunately experience this, when you're injured or sick or something, you're almost more focused because there's that little distraction. And so we just knew that we needed to come together and be really solid. So it was as if time slowed down, and yet it was all happening so fast. It was sort of a blur around us.
And do you remember those performances, like, very specifically? Or like, I mean, yeah, like when I go and race, I'm so in it that once I'm done, it's hard for me to actually be like, okay, at like the 250 meter mark. I mean, it's completely different. I'm like, I don't even know.
that's very cool to be able to hit that. I remember key moments, absolutely nothing about the original dance, which was probably our most ambitious program. Nothing. I wouldn't be able to tell you what our starting position was. Like, I don't know anything that happened.
Oh, wow.
Program. Cool. But our free dance, yes, I remember having moments, and we had cues together. And I mean, Scott almost hit the boards. We ended facing the wrong way. I remember thinking at one point in the footwork, like, oh, I'm actually enjoying this. So there are certain key moments that I can remember from that. Yeah. But overall, I think, you know, with time, and Scott reminds me of this, it's really easy to romanticize. It's easy to look back and think, oh, it was perfect, or it was just this dream. And then really, it wasn't. We just happened to be, you know, even when we weren't our best, we were better than other people.
Yeah, totally. Why do you think that we're able to do that, romanticize previous experiences, even if those experiences weren't as good as what we are thinking that they were in the moment?
I think it's a self-preservation thing, right? That selective memory. Probably even why women want multiple children at some point at the birth, you know? I think that's a way of moving forward and always just thinking that that exists. Like, we want to feel like that what we're striving for is worth something, and that fairy tale does exist, you know?
I'm not sure. I think that's a really good point. I'm not sure, because even like for me in my sport, like there's a lot of times in training, in competition that like, especially competition, where I go into like the most amount of pain I'll ever be in up until this point, or up until maybe if I have kids. but right when I'm done, then I'm like, let's do that again. Right. Yeah. But like when you're in it, you're like, this is
it's the worst.
Yeah.
You have that fear beforehand, knowing that you're going to want to die, like that you're going to be in so much pain. Is there a,
yeah, I've had, I do have that, but I think I've definitely been able to position myself or change my thinking that like now I'm striving to hit that. So like I want to go into a race being like, I want to be in more pain than anybody else, rather than going in and being like, oh, I don't want to feel this, because it's inevitable. It's going to happen. Yeah. So if I can go in and be like, okay, I want to be in more pain than the other boat beside me, then I think I could get more out of myself or that competition, or like give myself more like I don't know, adrenaline to be like, yeah, okay, I'm working harder than they are.
That's powerful. I just got goosebumps when you said that. Our brain just wants to protect itself from any kind of pain. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's, I think when you see athletes self-sabotage or come up with, you know, these excuses even before getting into a situation, because we're just so fearful. Yeah. And I think to sort of reframe that is amazing.
Thank you. No, it's, I think it's, I had a coach in my novice year that like her, what do I want to call it? Like overall goal for us was just being fearless. Mm. It was just going into competition and into training and being fearless. And I think it is very powerful if you can go in and feel fearless, because yeah. Then you have nothing to lose, and you're just going out and doing your best effort, and that's all you can do.
Right. And that doesn't even mean that you won't feel fear. Mm-hmm. In fact, you probably will, but it's acknowledging yeah. And then just, you know, blowing ahead regardless.
Yes. And, yes, know, exactly.
Yeah, that's, I like that a lot.
Nice. So after 2010, what'd you guys do? What were the next 4 years like?
I had another surgery. So it was my second on my shins and calves for a chronic injury. And it was sort of in that recovery where I realized I consider getting a third surgery at some point in 2012, and it was just not getting any better. Mm-hmm. So we totally stripped down our skating mechanics and mm-hmm. changed our movement patterns and changed our technique, everything about that. I mean, it was like learning a new language almost. Wow. And so that was a process, but it fueled us in a way that it intellectualized our training. It was more scientific in the approach. We were just learning. It felt like we were students, mm-hmm. like really students of the craft again. And that was fun. And we assumed at that point that that was our sort of our last push. We would finish after 2014. Wow. And, but I do think we got lost, especially leading into those Olympics, wanting to defend the title mm. and thinking that anything less than that was a failure, and probably trying to appease so many other people. You know, yeah. Everyone had really loud opinions of the kind of team we should be. Mm-hmm. And we lost ourselves in the process, just trying to be what other people wanted.
Mm-hmm. How do you think you could deal with that? Like in that moment, I think that's so tough. And actually I had Simon Whitfield on before, and he talked about it kind of a similar way, which was like after 2000 when he won a gold medal, then there was just so much noise that coming around of what people wanted, what he then thought that he had to put out for the next games, and by the time he got there it was like just get it over and done with. Mm-hmm. I think that takes a lot of I don't even know self-reflection during, or like how do you think you are able to manage that in that experience, or were you guys able to?
I don't know that we did it well, to be honest. I think what helped us was that it sort of isolated us from everything, you know, even our coaching staff. It became just the two of us against the world. So it emboldened us within our partnership to sort of feel fearless, as mm-hmm. you said, but we were also probably lying to ourselves or trying to convince ourselves that that we were heading in the right direction when deep down we probably knew we weren't. So looking back, I mean, I just wish that we were a little bit truer to our vision of who we wanted to be, but maybe we didn't know it, you know? Yeah. I mean, now I realize like no one cares. You think people do. And, you know, people are quick to give an opinion or criticize and judge, but then they move on and no one really is that invested
totally
in your career the way you think they are.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, had we taken that burden off of ourselves a little bit earlier, it would have been nice. But that said, Sochi was, you know, such an incredible experience. We loved it. We loved every single second of that games. Mm-hmm. It was probably the most enjoyable Olympics for us.
Really?
Despite the silver medals. Yeah.
Wow. And why was that?
We were just present and we were determined to enjoy it. We just took it in. We'd bike around the village and just be so happy and connect with athletes and cheer on our fellow teammates. And just, we wanted to like be everything that the Olympics stands for and offers you. Mm-hmm. So I think that willingness to be present and not wanting to, you know, miss a moment of it really like brought gratitude to the forefront and it just made the experience so great.
Mm-hmm. I was just kind of laughing when you were talking about, despite the silver medal, you're such a high performer that even in your voice, you say, despite the silver medal, did you feel like the performance itself was the best that you guys could have put out? Or do you feel that it wasn't? And so you kind of have this sort of reservation towards the silver medal? Because I find often like, you could put out not you as Tessa, but anyone could put out an amazing performance. And I do this all the time. Like if I go out and put out a performance, it's so hard for me not to look around and be like, oh, I actually just lost, yes. You know, like, whereas if I'm so in it, put out that performance, that's all I could do. But the result wasn't that or what I had expected. And so then you start to feel like it wasn't worthy enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an interesting dichotomy, isn't it? Because you'd almost rather, I don't know, actually I shouldn't speak for you or in rowing, but
no.
I think we figured out that we would rather have the feeling that we want, you know, of just like being so prepared and executing in the way that we imagined and practiced and come second or third or 10th.
Totally.
Rather that than win and feel bad about the performance. And we'd had those, like we had a world championship where we won, it was our second title. And it was so unfulfilling because it wasn't a great performance in our minds. So with Sochi, not so much for the team event, but for the individual side of things, we could not have skated those programs better. Oh, we were really content. We didn't like one of our programs and it was a bad program. So we probably, you know, we did deserve second. It wasn't that we were bitter towards the actual result. Mm-hmm. It was just that it was compared to the 2010 gold and, you know, just that sense of defending a title, I think things or just sort of redefines that.
Mm-hmm. And then what made you guys go into 2018?
We took time away from the sport and got some healthy perspective and being able to sit in the stands and watch a competition and be really removed from even that training process made us realize just what a gift that is to be able to wake up every day and pursue something that you believe in. And to feel like there's a whole team of people around you committed and invested in your success. And, you know, being a finite period of time in your life, we realized, okay, we want to do things differently. And we wanted to work with different coaches. We wanted to have a different style. We wanted to explore a different way of training. Ice dance is really archaic in its methods. Right. And we wanted to sort of advance that and simply disrupt some things in the figure skating world. So I think that really kind of got us excited again. And we made the move to Montreal and we kind of planned our 2-year comeback.
Wow. That is so awesome. And what was that?
You
loved it.
Yeah. I loved every moment, every single moment of it, even in those like double run through, I'm going to collapse because I'm so tired moments. I loved it.
Wow.
Nothing better. Yeah.
And because you felt like you had nothing else to prove, or why do you think that was?
Because we were finally like fully in control. And we knew what we stood for. We knew who we wanted to be and like what version of Tessa and Scott we wanted to present in PyeongChang. And we just, even within our team, we worked with B210. And so we would sit around the boardroom once a month with 14 to 20 coaches. And like we would drive the meetings and we would try and get the best from all of our coaches and staff members. And it just felt different. It just felt like we were a business, you know? And I know that seems to take the love and passion out of it, but it actually did the opposite. It instilled the sense of professional purpose.
Yeah. I think it probably brought back autonomy.
Yes.
And, you know, being able to, which is so interesting. I get so fascinated with sport and how, like, we know this in real life. Like, when you give people autonomy, they usually feel, you know, more worthiness or more ownership. But then in sport, we like to take that away from athletes so quickly. And it's like, you can only get autonomy when you are like top in the world, and then maybe, and for like a serious amount of years, and then maybe we'll give you some. But it's still like, why is that the case? Like, why isn't coaching and athlete partnership more of a partnership rather than a dictatorship? Or
that's such a good question. And I wonder, you know, a lot of that comes back to the power imbalance and that authority figure student relationship, where from a young age, you're almost taught to not question anything. You know, you just do as you're told and you push yourself to the limits and you don't complain about it. Mm-hmm. And what the coach says goes. And it's really unhealthy for a lot of reasons. But having that ability to question something, you know, and having a coach that is receptive to that and make it a conversation is empowering in every way, because then you're also behind like the reason for doing something. It can all come back to the why.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And then when you're actually performing at the end of the day, then you can go out and put out your best effort forwards, because you're like, I did this, or I wanted to do this, rather than not blaming somebody else. But it's so easy when there's so many people dipping their hands in one pot, then it's easy to then also, when you don't get the result, you could blame it on other things, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But no, that's really interesting. And so did you guys find that in 2010 and 2014, you were kind of just listeners rather than actually able to put out what you wanted? Or
I mean, we were probably the best athletes to coach, because we would just like eat out of your hand. We wanted every bit of piece of information. We just wanted all the feedback. We wanted to please, and we wanted to be perfect, and we would have done anything. I mean, if a coach, you know, whatever a coach asked of us, we would have sort of done it. And I'll say more Scott, only because he grew up with a family of coaches. And so that was really instilled in him and ingrained in him. And I think then coming around to this idea of, you know, we can be active participants of our training and we can kind of manage this ourselves, you know, really changed the trajectory of things.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And what was your partner? Now I'll get into the partnership of you and Scott. How did you guys navigate that over a long period of time? And I mean, if I think about any sort of partnership, it's, I think about also like relationships, in the sense that like often people who are having conflict within a partnership or relationship, it might not even be to do with the fact that that partnership isn't working, but there's so many other life impacts that are coming at them that then they're just turning it towards their partner. So how did you guys kind of navigate life and a partnership over a long period of time like that?
Well, it took a lot of work. I mean, we were lucky early on because one of our coaches studied psychology, and she sort of helped us kind of create this foundation of trust and communication and shared goals. Basically, I would say it all came back to the shared vision of success and understanding that we needed one another. But we did a lot of sports psychology, a lot of mental prep work, a lot of marriage counseling. Ultimately, even though we weren't a romantic couple. And I think it was just the dedication. We woke up every day determined to commit to each other and invest in one another. And we also understood early on that it was no good to blame one another or fight or bicker or argue, name call, whatever, not only did that waste precious training time that we just could never afford. Mm-hmm. We always wanted to be efficient, but it also, it was sort of the antithesis of what we needed as athletes. Like, we needed to build each other up so that, like, I wanted Scott to feel like the most confident, powerful, like, skater of all time. And I think he wanted that for me, because that's the only way that you can feel great about yourself on the ice. And so to sort of bring one another down, which is a slippery slope, and we saw a lot of teams go there, just never made sense to us. So I think it was just like a daily commitment to wanting the other person to feel really good.
Yeah, that's so awesome. And what were some of the efforts or work that you talk about that you guys had to do in order to make that happen?
One thing we decided early on was to not coach one another. We had a team of people who could tell us things and to make corrections and give feedback. And in fact, we would be a little bit defensive of one another, but we never flipped that on each other and decided to say, like, hey, you need to do this.
That's really cool.
What we could say was, it would help me if you lifted your arm here or carved out a different edge here. It would really help my existence on the ice. But we just never coached. And I think that was really healthy, because again, it was the two of us always receiving the same sort of feedback from coaches.
Wow. That's really cool. And I think I'm trying to think with rowing, we kind of, we don't have that same sort of, approach, I don't think, or especially in the crews that I'm in right now. Like, we definitely, you know, we have somebody in bow who's kind of coaching the people in front of you. But I think it's also, like you say, positioning how you say those things, you know, like, rather than saying, I need you to do this, it'd be like, if you could do this, this would really help me, you know? And it's so crazy how you can just change your language in a way to get the same end result without having all that sort of complication during.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's true. It's everything really in that delivery and how that can be received.
Yeah. And so what were your coaches like with you guys over those years? And I can't imagine how that sort of partnership was also playing into the partnership of you and Scott.
Yeah, I think ultimately, especially near the end of our career, we learned that it was our job to get the best from our coaches. So we've sort of flipped the script in that we studied and analyzed our coaches' insecurities, defense mechanisms, coping strategies, so that especially at certain times in the season when we needed someone to be creative, we knew exactly what to say and do to bring out that side of them.
That's cool.
And yeah, and then empower them to feel really good and feel like they could also take ownership of the process. And like, we wanted everyone in our sphere to be invested, genuinely invested in our journey. So we did spend considerable time and effort in sort of bolstering their confidence. Mm-hmm. I think they understood that we also had our own little language and way of working. So as soon as we pushed away from the boards, it was the two of us out there on a little island. And maybe eventually just finding that open communication of being able to share vulnerabilities or ask, like, what is our focus today? Or I'm feeling really nervous. How can you help me? And bringing our coaches into those conversations was a helpful sort of shift.
I'm just picking up on the little, when I'm nervous, do you think that when you say that or state that aloud, then that helps to deal with it? Or do you think that keeping that internally and just letting it move past you gets you over those sort of nerves? Or do you think you have to speak truth to it?
I'm an extroverted thinker. So I'm an introvert, but the way that I think, I have to hear myself say things out loud. And if a coach gives me some piece of information or feedback, I have to also say it just to sort of solidify that. So I don't think that I could have kept it in. And conversely, Scott did for maybe over a decade of our partnership. I thought he was just this superhuman athlete that never got nervous, never got tired.
Yeah.
And it ended up being sort of an issue between the two of us, because I would feel less than And I would question myself and I would think, I'm not doing enough. I'm not trained enough. I just like, I can't keep control of my nerves. And he was feeling all of those things too, but his way of coping was to sort of project this inherent confidence. And then, you know, once we sort of identified that, I'm sure it was through therapy that, then we could talk about it. It was so empowering just to be able to say, then it's out there and you just move on. You acknowledge it and you have a couple keywords to each other. Or your coach knows as they're, you know, saying their final words before you go off, then they know sort of what mindset you're in too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a really good point of establishing those sort of feelings aloud, especially in a partnership, or else what you're saying, you're somebody who is projecting more vocally. And so then over time you start to feel, oh, this is just me. I'm doing all this, like all this chaos, all these nerves. This is only me. Oh my gosh. Now you're starting to question there's something wrong with me rather than this is so natural and it's going to happen to anybody. You know, right. I think you're so right. Establishing that those truths and saying them, I think, allows you to put them away probably pretty quickly as soon as they come out.
And what a funny sort of unwritten rule of the athletic world that you're not really allowed to be weak or vulnerable or, you know, let your guard down. I don't know if you've ever felt that. Are you good at verbalizing your feelings in that sense?
I think I take pride in the fact that I love communicating and, I'm even like confrontation. I think the quicker you can, if I have a feeling towards someone, and I think this is, I'm similar maybe in your aspect where like, I need to quickly talk about it or else like, I can't sit here and let it manifest for like more than a couple hours without me having to go and talk to somebody. And I think that also comes from the fact that like I may be a people pleaser, and so if I feel that somebody has some sort of negative effect on me or something, then I'm like, okay, I want to deal with this right away because I want to get past this. And I've also just noticed, I think over the years, I think it also comes from being in a big family. The more that you can talk about it, then you know, you're not coming up with your own narrative in your head of what's going on. Because the times that I'll come forward and say something, and then I listen to somebody else say something on my team, and it's a completely different perspective, then I'm like, whoa, I'm really glad we talked about this.
Yeah, even though you're living the same experience.
Right? Yeah. And this happens just in the boat where like, if I'm in a pair or a four or an eight, whatever's going on, but like we'll go and everybody's feeling different things in whatever seat they're sitting. And so we'll row 2 kilometers and it's kind of quiet. And then all of a sudden I'll say something like, I kind of feel it down on star. So like star or port. And then somebody else in front of me is like, I feel it down on port. And I'm like, whoa, you're feeling the complete opposite than I am. I'm glad we talked about this. So then we can just maybe sit up and we know the cues in order to then come together and feel balanced again, but we're feeling totally different things. So then our bodies are doing different things at the same time too. And I think those little things in sport then also translate into life where, I don't know, if I have a personal feeling about something, I just think it's better to talk about it. I don't know if that's like innately how I've always been or if that's something that I've learned over time.
That's an incredible quality there's such value to that. I personally had to learn through experience and maybe just some maturity for that, because I would have held on to things. I would have waited for the right time to mention something. My mom I don't know if I've ever said this before, but my mom used to remind me that even when I was 8 or 9 years old and I would come home and something that Scott would have done or said might have bothered me or hurt my feelings. And she'd say, you should tell him how you feel. And I'd say, okay, next Thursday at 3 p.m., I can broach the subject with him. And then the following Monday at 4:30, I'll be able to finally express it. I think he'll be in the right space and blah, blah, blah. Like there was so much analysis to trying to have the perfect scenario in order to have the difficult conversation. Mm-hmm. And that was a pattern that I set really early on. And then, you know, with a lot of work and experience, realize that to your point, it's so much better to just not let that time pass and to just articulate your feelings as soon as you can.
I wonder if we are so hesitant to, oh, well, first it's like, obviously being vulnerable is a very tough thing, but I wonder if it's so tough for certain people because they had bad experiences growing up where they decided, I'm going to go talk to this person and tell them how I feel. And then that person was like completely antagonizing or made them feel terrible. So then now they have these little like micro traumas and then they grow up and now it's for them to be confrontational. They can't because they're so fearful of what has happened. Right.
Yes. That's such a good point. And it makes you think about how you can better receive feedback or criticism that way in order to, you know, make that experience acceptable for someone else giving that. And it comes back to that we all have trauma, things in our childhood, things in our upbringings that affect the way we communicate and how we present ourselves. And it always comes back to something like that. And just like, whether you've dealt with it or not, there's a shadow there that lives with you and how you approach everything.
Well, actually, somebody else that always brings me back to vulnerability is Brené Brown.
Oh, I love her.
Really good. And I mean, her stories, and I mean, I listened to her podcast, but her episode on Netflix as well, like where she talks about people being vulnerable. Like, I think when you know that when you're going into a vulnerable space, that you're going to feel these things. It's the same thing of what I was saying about, I'm going to be in a lot of pain through this race. So that's inevitable. It's going to happen. It's about moving past that and knowing that on the other side, there's going to be something great. And I think with vulnerability, the more you do it and the more positive feedback you get from it, then you're more able to go forward and do it again with other people. And
it's a practiced skill, right? And I, you know, there's that misconception that you either come by it naturally or not. And I think it has to be, you have to be able to put yourself in that uncomfortable position repeatedly and practice saying the things that are really hard to say so that it just becomes more part of your existence. That's a great point.
Yeah. No, definitely. Gosh, I keep thinking of these similarities between your sport and rowing, and I can see how Marty McBean was your mentor for so many years. I think it's really, really cool. What were some of the things that maybe she instilled in you guys over the years?
Oh, I have just notebooks full of quotable quotes from Marnie, and she lived each Olympic experience with us in different ways. But I remember the one thing that I still think about, she would say that someone is going to show up on February 20th, no matter the weather, doesn't matter what the ice conditions are, doesn't matter what your music is, it's just someone's going to show up and win. At the Olympics. So why not you? And the moment she said, why not you? Then I would just think, oh yeah. Like, oh yeah, I never put myself in that category. Why didn't I? So simple things like that were just mind blowing to us at the time. And even just practical advice on how to manage an Olympic Games. Like, she was the one who told us to get new phone numbers, give your number to 6 people total. Sort of block out the rest of the world. Just stay really focused, have a strategy with your family and friends of who can call you or text you and when. And often it was that we needed to reach out first. Like, we just, things like that. And now maybe it's different because social media and people, I don't know.
I've totally thought about that though too. That's a very good point.
Everyone comes out of the woodworks and wants to connect. So just little things like that made just the world of difference.
The why not you? Why do you think you had to think about that in order to believe it, to move forward? Or why do you think you had those like preservations of why not me, you know?
Yeah, I feel like because it was really easy for me to look at everyone else and think that they had it together or that they, you know, knew what they were doing. I remember sitting at, it was one of those pre-Olympic conferences where they bring speakers in. And Ashton Eaton, the decathlete, was there.
Oh, yeah. Speaking.
And I mean, like, just probably the athlete of all athletes. And he walked on stage and I wrote in my notebook, he looks like a normal human. And that was a revelation to me. It was just like, wow, these normal people can do extraordinary things. Even seeing Alex Bilodeau in the village after he won. And, you know, he was just in the cafeteria probably after he had competed, was getting McDonald's, let's be real. But mm-hmm. just the way that he was conducting himself, I thought, wow, he's just, you know, he's a normal person, but he just did something really incredible. And mm-hmm. I think I had maybe just put the idea of Olympic success on such a pedestal, like that I couldn't possibly be in that category with those mm-hmm. people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we do
a little bit.
I mean, I think we do that all the time. I like the quote less, which honestly, going into this conversation with you, is always in my mind too, which is like less impressed, more involved. And so mm-hmm. if I can be less impressed with the title of Tessa Virtue or everything that you've accomplished and just be involved with exactly what you're saying and doing, then, you know, then you can have an actual conversation with somebody and feel like you're connecting with them without all these other things that they've achieved. You know, at the end of the day, we're all human, respect each other, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I think you get the most out of other people too when you are just completely present in what you're saying and doing. And
less impressed, more involved. I love that.
Less impressed, more involved.
That one.
Nice. Awesome. Anything else? I think, I mean, we kind of hit a lot of everything. This has been super enjoyable for me. What were your last sort of feelings when you guys decided to retire? Was it always kind of known? Did you feel like this is time, or did you, like, what were your feelings of when you actually left the sport?
I think, well, we couldn't have been more fortunate. Mm-hmm. to do it the way we did. It was such a sense of contentment, just feeling like we really did accomplish the things that we set out to do. We were living on our own terms, mm-hmm. in our own way. And we both had passions and things to pursue that felt worthwhile and exciting and challenging. And I realized that not many people get to retire in that way and on those terms. Mm-hmm. It was difficult even still, just coming to terms with, you know, what's the new purpose and how do I identify myself beyond that title that other people, almost more other people, impose on you. Mm-hmm. But I just feel so lucky. I feel so lucky to have experienced those things and to have, you know, even have been able to cultivate that partnership that allowed us to do it together. Feel really proud of, but just to kind of, in true athlete fashion, just sort of on to the next, you know, mm-hmm. what now? And, you know, probably need to celebrate our successes a little bit more, but it's exciting to think about, okay, where do I go from here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. One last question, actually. When I think of you both, then I think of you guys kind of uniting, this is kind of intense, but uniting Canada. During your journey, did you guys ever think about that was like you wanted to do that, or that was a goal or a mission, or was that just something because of what you guys were doing that it just happened?
That's so lovely of you to say, really. But no, I think what we were very, very conscious of was representing Canada. Mm. And so we really thought a lot and spent time writing notes and having lengthy, robust discussions about what it meant to be Canadian and what values, you know, Canadians embody and cherish. And even, you know, when we were in junior, taking the ice on an international competition, hearing representing Canada, mm-hmm. Tessa Virtue and Scott Meyer, was always a really powerful thing. So I think that felt more like a responsibility.
Right.
But one thing that we did, and I credit Marnie and Scott with this, like this mentality of letting our skating speak for itself. So not wanting to buy into our own press of whether we had sponsors or didn't have sponsors or whatever kind of hoopla was happening around us. We always wanted our results and achievements to come first. Mm. And then the other stuff can follow. Mm-hmm. But we just never wanted to get carried away with anything other than our craft and our product. Mm-hmm. And so I think that probably helped keep us really focused and grounded on it.
Yeah.
But that's so nice. And also, you know, when you're part of an Olympic team, you just see it, you see it around you. It's in mm-hmm. every athlete on the team. And I can only imagine the summer, they're double. So it's just so many, but it's like, you're just one of many. You're just one little tiny storyline of so many, you know, great moments.
Yeah. No, that's so amazing. I think it was your last, I think it was the team or the, which one, where Tragically Hip was your song?
Oh yeah. It was the gala, the final. Okay.
The final one. Yeah. I have the very, specific memory of this. So 2018, I was at training camp. I went to UBC and we were in Arizona and we had it all queued up on the TV. The entire team was sitting there. There's like 22 of us girls. It's just the women's team. And we were all just like sitting on the floor watching it. And I remember all of us just like, nobody said a word and we were just all in such awe.
That's so sweet.
So it brings me great joy to sit down here with you today and share a conversation, because you have instilled a lot of inspiration for myself as an athlete, even though it's a totally different sport. I admire everything that you've done and respect everything that you've done. And it's been really nice to understand more of who you are and why you chose the things that you did in order to achieve the amazing outcomes that you achieved. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for such great conversation. I mean, I have a million more questions that I could ask you, but your ability to reflect and dive deeply within yourself is so cool to just see firsthand. And I know that you have some intense training coming up and a lot of stress and pressure, and just know that you have so many people in your corner, and I'll be cheering my heart out. And
thank you.
Wishing you all the very, very best. You deserve it.
Thank you so much. I always find these final words in each episode quite difficult because I'm trying to express the amount of enjoyment I receive from talking to people like Tessa. Tessa, thank you so much. You are an inspiration to so many of us, and I look forward to watching all the amazing things that you're going to continue to accomplish. Thank you to my systems engineer, Sydney Payne, Claire Briand for background music, and thank you again to all of you for listening. Next episode, airing June 14th, will be with Marnie McBean. Have a wonderful day. Go get after it. Thanks, everyone.